Oh, we could just listen to that forever. And
what did you say?
I just said a word not allowed on there.
I'm glad we missed it, and we'll scour the tape and try to remove it. Okay. How are you all? Good morning. Welcome. We are listening to the music of the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson. Of course, we lost Brian Wilson last week, and we were in fun drive, so we could not give a proper tribute, and we will do that. We'll also do that for Sly Stone tomorrow, yeah. I believe. So a lot going on, and again, we just want to say we're back. We had a show yesterday. We'll have a show today, and hopefully we'll keep going right until the next fun drive, which is in October, which seems really far away and isn't. But again, my thanks to everyone who participated, everyone who was a part of it. Thanks to, and I mentioned your name yesterday, Teresa, but Teresa, who came in and answered phones during the drive, and we really appreciate you not only giving of your time here, but giving of your time in the Fun Drive room as well.
Delighted to do it. I enjoy talking to people on the phone, and so many new members. Wow.
Yeah, it was
wonderful.
Very nice.
Yeah. And
sustaining members, new members, very nice.
People were very, very kind. I always learned a lot talking. Thanks for everybody who supports what we're doing here, and cheers to you all for making it work.
Well, we certainly appreciate that. We have a lot going on in the world, and we have a lot to talk about, so we'll get right to it. Let me introduce everybody to you. Get my paper here with everything. I used to know these by heart, and then 2 weeks of fun drive, I forgot everything. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa, once again. Thank you very much. Always lovely to have you in the room.
Delighted to be here. There is a lot to talk about.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Joe. I usually do this shtick about the what special day is.
Yes.
Well, today is the International Panic Day, which I think is just really apropos to the topics we're going to talk about.
Sometimes it's a bad week to stop sniffing.
Yeah, life is stranger than fiction.
Isn't every day lately Panic Day?
It feels that way.
Yeah. Okay. But this is the special. Yeah. Today's the day you write your cards and letters.
It's Groundhog Day again. Yes.
and that's different than Panic Attack Day.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That's tomorrow.
I assume they come tomorrow, right? Or in a day or two.
That's at midnight.
The voice you just heard is that of Jim Ketterer, senior fellow. Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Jim, always a pleasure to have you on this program. Thank you very much for being here.
It's nice to be back after a while away, and congrats to you and the station.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to be back. Jay Jochnewitz, editor-at-large columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. I'm so glad to be back after the fun drive. I was worried all through it. There was nothing happening, and I was like, oh, my God, what am I going to talk about when we finally get back?
I know. <Yeah. laughs> You know, it was funny. Yesterday we started off the show, and I asked the group just to come up with the story that they missed talking about, but nobody could really remember. There's been such a barrage that it was hard for people to figure out like the story that they missed, because it's just every day has been a blizzard. And because I said personally, I miss the
That's
whole.
That's not snow, Joe.
No. I missed the. We didn't get to talk about the Elon Trump fight, and then somebody in the panel said, "Oh no! Like that was before we went on." I said, "No! All a 2 week period of time. That's what happened. All that stuff happened, but." Don't worry, there's much more to discuss today, and that's exactly what we'll do right now. We welcome you, the listener, to join in and to be a part of our discussion and talk about what is happening. And we welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we thank you very much for being with us as always. Okay, so here's where we begin, and that is the international news and about war and very concerning news that comes to us, and we'll do our best to look at what is the most recent elements here, and the going back and forth, which of course makes it even more difficult to kind of get your handle on it. So first, we'll talk about the U.S. debating the bombing of Iran and of that decision, which could pull the country into a major war or lead to the destruction of Iran's nuclear program. That'll be one segment of our conversation. And then separately, I would like to talk about of how the president shifted on Iran under pressure from Israel, and look at that aspect of the story as well, which I think is a big part of the story. Of course, there was the G7 taking place in Alberta. The president left early to deal with these issues, and then was very cagey as to why, and that was a whole thing as well. So we'll work our way through as much of it as we possibly can. But we begin with the news that comes to us that and this, it was a back and forth really the yesterday and for a while, quite frankly, with the G7 agreement, there wasn't the president said he wasn't going to sign it, and then did before he got on Air Force One and took off for Washington, but. From the Washington Post, President Donald Trump faced one of the most monumental decisions of his presidency as he debated whether to join a war against Iran that risked sucking Washington into a new Middle Eastern conflict, but also offered the chance to eliminate a foe's nuclear program. In a string of social media posts across the day, the president said that the United States has, quote, complete and total controls of the skies over Iran. Warned Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Am I saying that correct, Jim?
Yeah, I think.
Khamenei. That he was an easy target and demanded, quote, shouty cap, unconditional surrender without defining what that is or what that means. As the day closed, and after an 80-minute meeting with top aides in the Situation Room, he spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to a White House official. The tough language came at a moment of extraordinary weakness for Tehran, whose power is at a low ebb following a year of Israeli attacks against its allies and proxies in the Middle East. Trump has long taken an aggressive approach toward Iran, although he also campaigned on ending global conflicts and as recently as last week continued to seek a new agreement to restrict its nuclear program, you know, to come up with a nuclear deal with Iran.
Who would have thought?
Yes. Bob Griffin.
So again, International Panic Day is apropos for this story. there's so many facets to this story, Joe, and I know you sort of laid out a very logical two steps, but they really do blend. The war itself and some of the language that's coming out of the United States is really bothersome to me. For our president to be calling for unconditional surrender in a conflict between Israel and Iran, I thought elevated our role. And sort of the first question that comes to everybody's mind is, you know, what role is the United States going to play? And our language of what our language certainly appears like we have taken positions. Certainly, we're moving resources, military resources, into the region, which raises another constitutional crisis that we could be facing about where are the war powers act and where is Congress. So let me sort of put that as a parking lot issue that we have to talk about the right of the president to unilaterally involve us in an armed conflict without Congress. The other issue that I'm watching. A couple other issues I'm watching really carefully is one is that the extent of Israel's control over the airspace, particularly over Tehran, is stunning, and I think sends some very, very interesting messages. But I will caution everybody before they get very excited about this. We had this type of technology, technological superiority in other wars, which caused the shift in thinking to asymmetrical warfare, which got us into these never-ending wars. And this is going to be, this has the potential to make what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan pale in comparison. So when you start to think about eliminating the threat of the Iranian nuclear program, we by nature, in order to consider that to be successful, the main site at Fordo, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, F-O-R-D-O, it's deep within a mountain. The only munitions that will work are munitions that the United States has. But it's not that easy. It's not that easy to say to Israel, we're going to slip you a couple of big bombs and you can go keep doing what you're doing. The only delivery of that weaponry would be United States planes, which means that if we're going to, through military means, eliminate the nuclear program in Iran, that we will have to get involved militarily, which is a huge step that has enormous implications. So when you start to think about you know cheering on Israel and you go Israel, you're doing the right thing, and we're going to sort of pretend that we're not involved. We can't pretend we're not involved if we're going to take those steps. In addition, I will also toss this out that if we do use the type of munitions that we're talking about at this site, then basically we're going to end up releasing what's the equivalent of a dirty bomb on the world, because there is so much product that is on site that's another whole catastrophe in the making. The couple other issues, and I'll turn it over to the other panel. I'm really concerned that Trump is being stampeded here. There's a lot of reporting, I think we're going to talk about, that he's setting policy based off of Fox News, which we knew and feared. But certainly it feels like the position is changing simply because Israel is winning so strongly, and he always likes to align himself with the winner. It's causing a massive divide, not really between the Democrats and Republicans, but within the MAGA world. I was fascinated by the Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz shouting match, which we should really talk about. And it's coming at a time where I don't think we're spending enough time being honest about Trump's cognitive decline, the fact that his cabinet is among the weakest that I have ever seen. And we would potentially going into war with a significantly weakened U.S. government. And if you think about all of the effects of DOGE, we have weakened the infrastructure of our federal government. So there's a lot of issues on the table here.
Jim Ketter.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple quick things in response, or just jumping off of things that Bob said, and then maybe I could step back and give some context as well. First off, with Trump and the kinds of things that he's saying, when he says he's always a master of saying the quiet part out loud. And there are certain things in the federal government, particularly in national security, that are quiet by design. So when he says we know where the supreme leader is, this violates one of the core tenets of information, which is you're essentially revealing sources and methods when you say that. You're saying to a very dangerous adversary, we have the ability right now to know this. And so, number one, you just don't want to tip your hand. Number two, if you're the Iranians, if you weren't onto it already, then you want to say, how do they know this? And they will reverse engineer it, and any kind of human or technological means, and probably a combination that allows us to do that, will be destroyed. And so the fact that he says these things, I mean, there are on occasion strategic reasons to say such things or to release such things. I mean, the Biden administration kind of strategically released information about our knowledge of Russian capabilities in Ukraine to put them on their back foot, but I don't think that's this. Second, I would just say it's really not a binary thing about, like, are we in or not? Now, obviously, as Bob said, it certainly crosses a line in terms of the use of military force, but we are essentially supporting Israel to do all of this. They're the largest recipient of U.S. foreign assistance, well over $3 billion a year. Most of that is military assistance. And so they would not be doing any of this without our assistance. So we are in already in many different ways. In terms of the role of Congress, this is a long tail of both parties and many administrations, really since the Korean War, granting again and again and again these kinds of powers to a presidency, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, in 2001 after 9/11, the authorization of the use of military force, which was the largest blank check you can imagine that was used for any number of things. Somebody who really was very thoughtful on this issue was former Congressman Chris Gibson. And when he was in Congress, he wrote a book, also, you know, PhD, former professor, former college president, very thoughtful on this. But right now we see and we hear, particularly on the Republican side, but the long history of this is not just Republican, granting presidents this kind of power. Also, to the point of the infrastructure of our government and also of our diplomatic corps. So at this moment, this is the kind of moment when you would be relying, the president would be relying on the U.S. ambassador to Israel and that ambassador's immediate staff for clear, sober, thoughtful, and informed analysis. And the ambassador Huckabee recently sent a message to President Trump saying that president would be getting messages from heaven on this, and that's not really out of the, and I'm not making that up.
No, you're not.
And that's not really out of the State Department training playbook in general. So there's that. Another thing is, if the U.S. were to engage in this military action, it would have to face the same test that Israel would have to face internationally, and that is, is this a preemptive war or is this a preventive war? And that's not just words that kind of mean the same thing. They mean something decidedly different. A preemptive war means there is an imminent threat. Netanyahu has been trying very hard to have it appear that there has been an imminent threat from Iran. I mean, I have no sympathy for the Iranian regime. I have huge sympathy for the Iranian people. But the Iranian regime is a dangerous and toxic regime. That having been said, there's no evidence that they were on the verge of doing something with nuclear weapons. And so that makes it a preventive war, which is a violation of international law. And if we also engage in a preventive war, that would be a violation of international law. Now, that all sounds very quaint, and I don't know if anybody really cares about that sort of thing anymore, but I do. And I'm betting there's a few people in the listening audience, and I think there's quite a few people at the G7 and other places who care about that. So I have so much else to say, but let me just leave it at that and turn it over to my other panelists. I'm really interested to hear what they have to say.
Just a quick shout-out. This event, unfortunately, is sold out, but I'm going to be in conversation with Chris Gibson tonight at the Kinderhook Bookstore, and he has a new book out called The Spirit of Philadelphia, which is this perspective on America's story told through the history of
You
ideas.
Might ask Chris about war powers, too.
We'll talk about that, I am sure. So, that is tonight. It is sold out, but anyway.
All right. We didn't even tee that up. I didn't
but
even
we
know.
We are going to be recording it, and we'll be broadcasting it here on our little radio show. Jay Jocknowitz, go ahead.
It's where to start. And then it just kind of opens up as
both of
you demonstrated. It's like you start on one thing and you move into all the other nuances of this. You know, the place I start Starting a couple of places. One is we would not be in this situation if the president had not canceled a not perfect, arguably imperfect in one key way, deal with Iran. And you know, many people felt we should have negotiated, we and others, other nations, should have negotiated a deal that got them out of the business of terrorism altogether. That was not going to happen with the Iranian regime. So they got a deal that held this off for 10 years. And again, not perfect, but it offered an opportunity, as I think I wrote about this some years ago, that it gave an opportunity for Iran to join the community of nations. And to show the Iranian people, the Iranian civilian, non-religious leadership, that there was another path to dealing with the world, to approaching the world. You could get rid of your revolutionary mindset, which I think a lot of Iranian people want to do and already have done. And as I said, join the community of nations. So we would that's hindsight at this point. The complete and total surrender or the complete and total control of the airspace is such a Trumpian thing to say. He gives the other time he likes to use that phrase is when he's giving endorsements to people. Subject, always subject to change, as this is subject to change. And I think the warning you point out that this is that we have some sort of such overwhelming military superiority here that if we drop our bunker buster on Fordo or a number of them, that somehow that's it. That's the game's over. We've won. Iran's going to be devastated. Nothing to worry about after that. It is such hubris to we have had the superiority for years. And once we get out of an air war and into a ground war, we're in a whole different situation. We have an extraordinarily well-armed and capable ground force to deal with in Iran, and that's not. And we have allies who are telling us this is not the way we want to see this resolved. I'd like to see Israel win this, quite frankly. I'd like to not have another belligerent nuclear power in the world, especially in the Middle East. But I don't know that that's possible. And when we talk more about the Trump manipulation aspect of this, I do think he's being steamrolled in the sense that Trump is always steamrolled. What he does is he sees a situation and then he tries to figure out what is the best way he can look the best in this situation. And we're at a point almost, and I think that's why he's holding off on Fordo, is that he doesn't quite own it yet. But he's going to own it if we drop a bomb. And then he's going to own the whole thing ever after. And I don't think he wants to be wrong. I don't think Congress, as you mentioned, should be deeply involved in this. I don't think Congress wants to be on his side. I don't think it wants to be on Israel's side. I don't think it wants to be on anybody's side but their own, and let him, great leader, figure this out. And as he goes, which is how he's doing it, I don't think there's a plan. I don't think there's anything but a day-to-day assessment of what's the best thing I can do politically.
And not to, I don't disagree with you at all, but a day-to-day, but a moment-by-moment. Tweet to tweet.
Yep.
So, Teresa.
Yeah, where to start, I think, is the key questions, because there's so many different aspects of this. Following up on what a number of you said, the thing that I worry about is who Trump is listening to, who he's surrounded by, what kind of information is available to them. And, Bob, I think you had said that Israel is winning. Which one of you said Israel is winning? I think that they're winning on Fox News. Certainly, I think that's true. I'm not sure beyond that. In some aspects, they are, but I'm not sure that winning the moment, but are they, if he does what Netanyahu is really pressuring him to do, which is to drop this you know, bunker bomb, when you can't just drop one, apparently you have to drop two, three, four, maybe five, Fordo. Thank you, Fordo. Sorry. But then the question becomes, and I went to the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Administration, to their site to see there's some recent statements and what they're saying there. And one of the concerns that they raise are, what are the both human and environmental implications of doing that? Because, as you say, it becomes a dirty bomb, and you create this potential serious, either it doesn't work, or if it does work, you create this very serious environmental radioactive situation, mm-hmm. right, with all sorts of implications. So there's that, but also there's the ripple effect. Okay, so what do you do next? And who goes on what side? And what does China do? And what does Russia do? And the reason I'm saying all that is you wonder who he's surrounded with, who's helping him think, not just do we do what Netanyahu is asking us to do, but then what do we do after that? How can you control that? And this is being done in the context of, first of all, him surrounding himself with people who don't have that much experience, him firing a number of generals and leaders who do, the DOGE cuts to our information gathering systems, right? Some key systems where people were dismissed, the deep DOGE cuts in the Department of Energy section that controls oversees the people who control and monitor nuclear weapons, right? Because they've been weakened as well. So it comes to the table in a very powerful situation in that we have the weaponry, but a very weakened situation in that do we really have the eyes, the advisors, and whatever? And also what I'm interested in hearing you folks talk about is Trump was on a very different path. You know, he was on this negotiation path with Witkoff. They were trying to come to some agreement to replace the agreement that he tore up. And where they were headed is, as I understand it, to rebuild basically back to the agreement where he tore up. And so I read some speculation that Netanyahu was very concerned that they might reach an agreement because Trump's so anxious to get this Nobel Peace Prize, and he thinks that's his route. And so Netanyahu went out ahead of him, maybe in the better to ask forgiveness than permission route, right? And so is sort of dragging him down this path away from the negotiation path. But where does that lead us if you don't have the right people around you, both to make the decisions and do the next things? That's not a statement. That's more of a question for you guys, the experts.
Do we have time? Are we going to break?
Let's go to break. We'll go to break. That's a lot of information we all need. I know I need just to...
It's a lot.
Soak that all in for a second. We'll come back. We'll talk more. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 45 minutes past 9 o'clock. And a very powerful first part of the program where our experts have been talking about what is happening in this pivotal moment in regards to Iran and Israel. We welcome your letters. We'll get to a few in just a few minutes. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Bob Griffin.
Joe, to amplify some of the comments that were made in the earlier section, I think it's really important. And a couple of my concerns. One is that I feel that Netanyahu's policies, Israel's policies, are actually driving us rather than being something that we're working cooperatively with them. And that really worries me. But it's also a concern I have is that in Trump's desire to go after the university systems, he's used this the argument of anti-Semitism as the club that he went after Harvard and Columbia and others. But what's happened though is that there's now this equation of questioning Israel's policies as being anti-Semitic, which I think is really dangerous. And I think that's leading to a silence on behalf of many in Congress, which again, I think is both feckless and dangerous to this country. So one issue is that I think we're getting dragged along here. And what worries me is that we're getting dragged along at the same time our president is suffering from a bruised ego, from his failed military parade, from economic indicators, from lots of things that he's pouting about, and the idea of appearing to be strong coincides with Israel's, you know, remarkable early wins in this event. I also want to talk a little bit about my concerns about the weakened net, that safety net that we had in other services. At the same time, we never want to come across as the villains in the story. And if we start to drop bombs, we're going to change the world's opinion of us even further. Even though I think it's been deteriorated considerably under Trump, but we don't have USAID. Okay, so right. So we've cut back on foreign aid. We've wiped our feet with all of our allies. We've done everything in our power to weaken our federal bureaucracy. In fact, if you start to think about what would the Iranian response to our involvement in a war be, you know, we'd have to talk about the increase in potential use of terrorism as a weapon, particularly if there's overwhelming military superiority. But think about who Trump nominated to lead the anti-terrorism program in the Department of Homeland Security. It's a 22-year-old kid whose claim to fame is that he worked in a campaign and he worked in a supermarket. I mean, so you know, we laugh about MAGA being, you know, morons are governing America, but the quality of people in the leadership roles in DHS, in the FBI, in the counterterrorism elements of it here in the homeland are so weakened that this really creates this whole envelope of concern.
Joe, can I just jump in too? I just want to throw out a couple facts as well. I mean, first off, though, I'm just jumping off one thing that Bob said about criticism of Israel or not. A fascinating thing did start to happen in the last few weeks where you saw Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, other luminaries on the right who have come out and have been critical of Israel. And I think you started to see some, both within Israel, within the United States and other places, Netanyahu appearing to have his back against the wall politically and playing a weak hand. And I think that had to be part of the calculation on this. And on nuclear weapons in the Middle East, it's worth remembering because although it's not part of the conversation here in the United States very much, I can tell you it's certainly part of the conversation in the Middle East all the time. Israel possesses nuclear weapons. They have since the 1960s. They have not admitted to it. They have not joined the non-proliferation treaty regime with all the controls that has. So whatever one thinks about that, I just throw that out there because it's part of the narrative in other parts of the world. Israel has also been, they have a long history of being active to ensure that they have nuclear domination of the region. In the early 80s, they attacked an Iraqi nuclear facility. They have had this long-standing kind of low-level but lethal policy toward Iran. There's been a wide variety of scientists who have been assassinated by Israeli services. The famous Stuxnet electronic disruption of the centrifuges in Iran that Israel and the U.S. was involved, but doesn't admit that it was involved, and on and on and on. So, you know, there have been some other states in the region that also attempted to sort of get them, Libya, Algeria. So this has been a kind of a backdrop, dangerous issue. But I would say this attack is not about nuclear weapons. Had it been about nuclear weapons, I think that Netanyahu would not have been so threatened by the fact that Trump was wanting to kind of redo the 2018, the thing that he undid in 2018 with the agreement. This is about regime change. Right. You could tell from the very beginning that it was a decapitation strike, not at the religious leadership, but at the military and scientific leadership. And so from the very beginning, I think Netanyahu didn't want Trump to negotiate that because, as Jay said, the range was constrained to nuclear weapons, as it was with Obama and as it would be with Trump, because you'd never get a deal otherwise. And Netanyahu said after the October 7th attacks, and you might remember he came to the UN and he had a map and he talked about the new Middle East that was going to be created. And we have seen this systematically over time. And it's not all bad results, but we have seen, you know, in fact, there's some good results that have come from it, but at a real cost. I mean, we've seen this arc of domination and of proxies from the Iranians. So Hezbollah has essentially been taken out of the picture, and Lebanon has been able to kind of form a government and do something in that direction. Syria, after the fall of Assad, has been pounded heavily by the Israelis. The Houthis are still out there as an issue to be dealt with. Iran is an issue. Hamas and their relationship. I mean, that this you know, what's happening in Gaza and West Bank, these have fallen off the pages, but this is all part of a broader strategy. And so Teresa said one thing that I remember Colin Powell saying way back when, a different kind of Republican. And he said two key things that I think are relevant here. One is the least asked question in Washington, and then what?
Right.
That's the kind of question we ought to be asking because we're about to use force. And the second one is the Pottery Barn theory. You break it, you buy it. And so we just don't seem to. We've talked even during the Obama administration. They talked about when I was there on the ground in Egypt, there was going to be this pivot to Asia, a pivot away from the Middle East. And it's like that scene, I think it's in Godfather 2, trying to get out, but just keeps pulling me back in. And the Middle East, you know, I mean, to think that we could attempt to remove the regime in Iran, this, again, is a toxic and horrible regime that most Iranian people would like to see removed too. But then what? How is this going to work?
I'd like to talk about that because I was trying to read in different places to understand where do they want it to go, because the and then what with the regime change, because clearly that's what Netanyahu is saying, this is really about regime change, right? But what they're doing is there was a dissident community growing in Iran, such it was capable of, but now as I hear and read, they're now coming together, you know, because it's now them against everybody else, right? So they're weakening. This is weakening any potential, those who would dissent. And does Netanyahu have any idea who would then take over? Do they? Because I read, I can't find it, and I see the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists I read there, they're very concerned about who would be next, what would be next. The IAEA is very concerned who would be next, what would be next. And that is a question that, you know, you need answered.
And in terms of the nuclear weapons, too, I mean, if there is actual evidence that the Iranians were about to do something, I think back to Cuban Missile Crisis. It was so effective when the Kennedy administration said, we have evidence, and here it is. Yeah. We're going to show this to the world. And that was so powerful. So if there's evidence, show it. If there's not evidence, then we have a whole nother problem. And I suspect it is that.
You know, Joe, if they really wanted to get rid of the government and science capability of Iran, they just should have sent Musk and Kennedy over.
Efficiency experts.
Yeah.
But this is, it's really the whole Doge impact on this is very serious. Again, go back to look at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists magazine. There's a whole story on. No, I know, but I.
Teresa may be the only subscriber in the room, but we understand.
That's a great magazine, by the way. A friend of mine used to be the editor of that magazine.
It
That's
really
a great
is.
Magazine.
It really is, if you want to, because I spent some time on the working on the spread of nuclear weapons, and it was...
I'm not mocking you. I'm inspired.
You're mocking
me. No, I'm inspired by you. I'm inspired.
We're laughing with you.
But really, go look if you want to.
Do they have a crossword?
I can't do crossword puzzles. You're mocking me. All right.
Jay, stop.
It's actually a code thing. You have to break
codes.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, figure out how to.
And you get to launch something if you do.
But this whole capacity issue that they've raised, like the what's next capacity in Iran, capacity in the United States, where's the information coming from? And remember Tulsi Gabbard, the DNI department, the National Intelligence folks, their intelligence, the U.S. intelligence was consistent with the IAEA's intelligence, which says that they don't have capacity yet for bomb capacity yet. Now, they could get there, but they don't have it yet. Netanyahu's been saying, for 20 years that Iran's about to have a bomb? Yep. About to have and having are different. And the question is, how do you pull them? What is the right way to pull them back? Is the right way through negotiation, or is the right way through a bunker buster bomb that only the U.S. can drop? And once they do that, then what? Because that opens up a wide variety of very dangerous things that you folks know better than me. And are we equipped? If there is then more targeted terror attacks, is the U.S. prepared for that?
No.
Probably
no.
not.
Nope.
Probably not. And I think it. You mentioned DOGE and the cuts and the decimation of advisory bodies. And I think that's even. You don't even need to get to cognitive decline, to get to not just Trump's incompetence. He is not a competent president to begin with. He gives the illusion.
He doesn't have the details.
Right. And so all the details that you're asking are the kinds of details that you would think, after all the mistakes we've made in the Middle East, in our own lifetimes, we don't even have to go back to, the 40s or the 50s. The mistakes we have clearly made ought to be paramount in people's minds in saying, what is next? And this is the problem with relying on Fox News and commentators. And here's a commentator talking. is that there's a simple narrative there. We're not doing nation building anymore. So we don't have to worry about what's next. All we need to do is fix the problem in front of us, which
but if
is
they
the
drop
allegedly
the bomb, they
pre,
do.
You know, imminent threat of a nuclear war that has been imminent since, or nuclear bomb that's been imminent since 2012, I believe. Netanyahu said this was next week.
All right, let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we have letters, so I want to get to the letters, and then we'll move on to some other subjects. A lot going on, as we mentioned from the very beginning. My thanks to our wonderful panel. We'll get back to the discussion after this break in news with Ray Graff. Oh, wouldn't it be nice? But it's panic day, so screw that. But
we'll
give it a shot.
Have we panicked you all enough?
Yes,
that's international panic day.
Panic day.
We're laughing, but we're not laughing.
We remember Brian Wilson this morning. All right, let's. We're going into some extra innings here, talking about this discussion, and it's important. And our group is doing a fine job as always. I would like to introduce the.
We need to up
letters.
Our game. We were great last time, but now we're just fine.
Yeah. No. I just want to include. I want to include listener letters, and here we go. Jared said, this whole Israel-Iran nuclear rhetoric is difficult to digest because of the double standards created by Israel. Israel has a secret, shouty caps, nuclear program. They refuse to let IAEA inspectors to inspect their nuclear facilities. They refuse to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. They then bomb every bordering country and expect them to disarm themselves. Lastly, Netanyahu has been warning imminent nuclear capabilities for over 30 years. That from Jared.
Thank you, Jared. All true.
we go to Thomas. Ever since he came down the escalator 10 years ago, the majority of Republican panelists have commented on Trump's strategies and actions as childish or incompetent or some combination of both. But Trump's decision to back Israel in denying a nuclear weapons program to Iran is neither childish nor incompetent. It is a simple recognition that this Iranian regime, which embraces an apocalyptic worldview that believes in the end of the world, cannot have the means to bring the end of the world about. Call it whatever you will, but many do not see it as childish or incompetent.
Well, I don't disagree with that point. I don't know that they're apocalyptic in the sense of wanting to bring about the end of the world, but I think, like any country, and I think this situation proves it for them, if they had nuclear arms, if they had one nuclear bomb or a number of nuclear or even a few, they would not be in the situation they're in. Nobody would attack them like this.
But there is a sect, a truly religious belief that the end of the world brings on the return of Muhammad, and so there is a messianic quality about war from the Iranian regime. My issue with the letter writer, though, is what you're advocating then is a declared war. I mean, that's basically what, let's just call it what it is. We're staring down the barrel of a war, and if that's what the decision is from the policymakers, then do it the right way.
Yeah, and I think Teresa said before, if in fact the letter writer is correct, and it is an open question as to the nature of the Iranian regime, which is not a great group of people, and you can just ask the Iranian people themselves to weigh in on that, but is it an irrational actor? They may in fact be a really horrible regime, and they in fact they are, but are they irrational in terms of their use of nuclear weapons if they were to have one? And maybe that's a bet that we don't want to try to have. So then what is the best way to deal with that? And the Obama administration had one approach. Trump undid it. Then he says he's going to redo it. And now this is happening. But I also think it's useful to kind of put it into the broader context of U.S.-Iranian relations. You know, people tend to think if they're old enough, like many of us in this room, they might say, oh, well, that goes back to 1979. But it actually goes back further. And if you look back into the time right after World War II, and when the British Empire and other empires were fading away, the British didn't want to fade away so quickly in Iran. And the U.S. and the U.K. worked together to carry out a coup that undid a democratically elected president, Mohammad Mossadegh, and which, by the way, was planned and implemented by Kermit Roosevelt, the son of Teddy, and Miles Copeland, who is the father of the police drummer Stuart Copeland, just in case anybody's keeping score at home. And so that was Operation Ajax, which then put him back in place of a brutal regime carried out by the Shah. And so when we became the Great Satan in 1979, that wasn't just a kind of a random decision that the United States is the Great Satan. And so what people tend to think, like the letter writer, and I don't totally disagree, but when they see Iran through the lens of the most virulent kinds of versions of a twisted version of Islam, there's also a lot of context and history that has to be factored into that. And Bob, when you were saying, when you started talking about a sect of a religion that is messianic and is talking about the end of the world and what that will bring, well, our ambassador in Israel is a Christian who shares this sect. So this is not reserved just to Islam. And so there's a lot there in that letter, but I think context and thinking about what it really means to then take next steps is important.
But Jim, I think it's really important, though. This is why the separation of religion and the state is so important in this country, and the blurring of the lines that we've seen leads to these additional complications.
Oh, I agree.
And
yeah.
And so when you see a lot of the changes that are being put in place right now, on the domestic level, that's why these issues are so disturbing to me, because these are all sort of playing into historically looking at the rise of a theocracy, and if you look at where Iran was prior to the Shah. But even under the Shah versus where it was under the theocracy, I mean, they were set back by generations. And you could see those same potential impacts happening here. No, it's not Islamic. It's the sort of the Christian nationalism. But we're following similar paths. And the question that I would put to everybody is this simple, is that it's not so much what Iran is doing, is that what kind of country are we?
There's that, but and there is a valid conversation to be had about the nature of the Iranian regime. I don't want to gloss over that, and the letter writer is correct in that regard. I mean, this is we've seen this through history. This is a revolutionary regime that has stayed revolutionary, and this is a problem for the United States. It is a problem for Israel, but it is also a problem for Arab states as well. I mean, the Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, the Gulfies. This is an enormous problem, the nature of this regime. But we ought to think about it in a way that is systematic and sober and likely to lead to the kind of results that would be in our interests and not counterproductive. And Jay was talking about basically hubris. And have we learned nothing in the last 30 years in our engagement in the Middle East? Apparently the answer is no.
But to the letter writer, I would also.
Or yes, we've learned nothing.
you mentioned the Shah and the overthrow of a democratically elected government and our interference in that. And I was wondering yesterday if one of the end games here, when Trump, you know, is calling for a complete and total surrender of the regime, does he want to put a Shah back in? You know, what does he imagine is going to replace this?
That's my big worry.
Yeah.
Have they thought it through?
They haven't.
But also with the letter writer, thank you for your writing, I think it's important to remember that there was a different path that the Trump administration was taking toward containment of Iran to get a nuclear weapon, right? So I don't think there's disagreement that I'll speak for myself, I don't believe that it's in the interest of the region or the world for Iran to have a nuclear weapons capacity, right? But how you avert that is the core question. And do you avert that in the path that Trump was on with sending his emissary Steve Witkoff and others to negotiate a settlement or some sort of containment? Or do you move? He has now been pulled this way by Netanyahu into the idea of you do it through force. And I think that's the fundamental question. It's not whether or not the U.S. would be part of a global effort, a unified effort to try to deter Iran from having a nuclear weapon. It's how that comes about. And I think there's a big difference between a negotiated settlement and the U.S. dropping a bunker-busting bomb.
I think if you want to know what the future is, probably if Netanyahu would give an honest answer of what he thinks it is, I think you were right. I think this was the closer we got to a deal, I think the more desperate Netanyahu got and said, I've got to sabotage this deal. The same way I think they looked to sabotage the Saudi deal and other agreements in the past. And I wonder, does Netanyahu even have an idea of how Israel would coexist and what a Mideast in which Israel can coexist and not be under the constant threat of terrorism, what that would look like?
But aren't those same questions valid questions for Gaza, mm-hmm. right? Of okay,
Gaza,
what's next?
West Bank,
the
Lebanon,
West Bank, what's
Syria,
next? Right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean,
right. And you have to ask that what's next question.
Two more. Let's just do a few more letters and then we'll
move on.
We'll take a quick break and then yes, move on. Joanne writes, Russell Vogt and the Project 2025 crew might love a world-ending war. Witness the U.S. ambassador to Israel saying that 47 is getting messages from heaven. We did allude to that earlier. Bob says Israel now has full air superiority over Iran, which means it can land special forces at Fordo that can destroy it without needing American superbombs. My guess is that Netanyahu isn't doing that yet because he wants to increase American involvement. We shouldn't fall into that trap.
And just to clarify, I think I said Tehran, the capital. I'm not sure it's complete air superiority over all of Iran. I didn't want to misstate. But the capital, they say that they have air control.
Yeah, it's my understanding that the only way to take that out is with our bunker bombs, and it's not even sure. Well, one won't do it, three, maybe four, and can you have recurrent strikes?
Or you have to land ground forces and begin a very costly ground campaign.
If you could even succeed, if given right. where it is yeah. and how
and
it's...
One of the things that I think, in addition to just the overall hubris that Jay was talking about, that has bedeviled American national security planning for these kind of conflicts in the Middle East is two things. One is a lack of really deep knowledge about on-the-ground
right.
situations, mm-hmm. and particularly in a place where we have not had an embassy since 1979. Embassies are not there just to do visas and cocktail parties. They have a real function in terms of knowing a place and having all kinds of relationships. And the second is that there's just a long-standing issue in Washington where there is a gap between our strategic aspirations and our actual capacity. And we have demonstrated that gap. We had such massive superiority in Iraq. And yet, look at how it turned out. And if we think that somehow, because we have air superiority, which has power but limited power, that that's somehow going to kind of rule the day in a complex, developed state like Iran, we are really in deep trouble.
And I also wonder and worry about Trump's decision to leave the G7 gathering. And in the press conference he did with Carney from Canada, where he spoke so much about his regret that Putin, you know, what had been the G8, and that Putin was kicked out. And he was hung on that for so long. I felt, you know, what's really on his mind about that? And, you know, in other administrations, both Republican and Democrat administrations, if you were at a gathering there of your allies and there was a global situation like in Iran, you would stay there and you would work this through with your allies. And so the question is, why didn't he feel the need to do that? And what was it about this Putin situation? And where is Putin going to be on this? And where is China going to be on this? Again, what are the steps after? Mm. And the steps after that.
All right. That is a natural place. Let's pause. We will go to a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up our last round for this incredible panel. We welcome you and your letters. Last call, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this.
My buddies and me, you're getting real well known. Yeah, the bad guys know us and they leave us alone. I get around.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And this just in from the Supreme Court. It's that time. It's decision time. In a decision that plunged the Supreme Court into yet another culture war feud, the justices on Wednesday upheld a Tennessee law banning all gender-affirming care for minors. In the last few years, fully half the states have adopted similar bans, leaving the other half so far allowing gender-affirming care in the form of, at minimum, hormone treatments prior to a teenager turning 18 years of age. The vote was 6-3 along conservative/liberal lines. Supporters of the bill were predictably elated over the win as State Senator Jack Johnson, the sponsor of the bill, put it in an interview with NPR late last year. The state bars minors from getting tattoos or smoking or drinking. And as he observed, we regulate a number of different types of medical procedures, and we felt like this was the best public policy to prevent kids from suffering from irreversible consequences, things that cannot be undone.
You know, what we have is it, are laws being made by people who really don't do, I don't think, do a deep dive into the issues that they're legislating on. And when you even do an amateur cursory read of these issues, of gender in particular, you come away with a very different impression. I mean, if you're willing to be open to things that absolutely challenge your fundamental, you know, binary idea of human sexuality. And I did this years ago when the a group of transgender people in Albany asked to meet with the editorial board. And I will be very honest, I rolled my eyes at the idea. It was like this seemed really far out to me. And this was early in the kind of people being out about their transgenderness. And I spent a few days researching this before the meeting so I could ask some intelligent questions, and I was stunned. There's a lot of smart scientific research on this, and it does challenge our, you know, what we think when we just take a simple look at the world, and that's a very hard thing to do. So, you know, on the other hand, I know that people look at this and they say, should children under 18 be making these decisions in a way that could be irreversible? And I respect that. But I don't think the folks in Tennessee have written a good law in the sense that, you know, parents are making, you know, parents ought to be able to make these decisions with their kids. And I don't think it's up to the lawmakers to be doing this.
The ACLU, which represented the challengers in the case, countered that the treatments that were at issue in Wednesday's case were endorsed as appropriate for teenagers by the major medical associations mm-hmm. that deal with gender dysphoria, including the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Endocrinology Association, and the American Psychological Association.
Smarter people than me. And I'm going to guess smarter people than or certainly more informed people than the Tennessee legislature.
All right. Anybody else on that? Okay. So we will move on and tackle our final story of this morning. And, let us go with Brad Lander arrested by ICE. And this is obviously brings up many issues, but is one that we can talk about in our last 10 minutes or so. Mr. Lander is the New York City Comptroller, also a candidate for mayor. He was handcuffed as he tried to steer a man past immigration and custom enforcement officers yesterday. He was arrested by federal agents at an immigration courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Mr. Lander, a Democrat, was observing proceedings at the city's main immigration courthouse at 26 Federal Plaza, where an increasing number of migrants who appear for court have been arrested in recent weeks by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. A spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security later said that Mr. Lander had assaulted and impeded a law enforcement officer, though as of Tuesday afternoon, Mr. Lander had not been formally charged. Videos taken by reporters at the courthouse show Mr. Lander standing by a migrant man in a hallway on the 12th floor when several men in plain clothes who appear to be law enforcement officers, some wearing masks, pushed past a crowd in the hallway to arrest the migrant. Mr. Lander repeatedly asked the agent whether they have a judicial warrant, refusing to let go of the migrant as the agents seek to shepherd the man toward the elevators, according to one of the videos, which was posted on social media by a reporter from The City, which is a digital news outlet. I will let go when you show me the judicial warrant, Mr. Lander says, his right hand on the man's body. Agents can be seen trying to pry Mr. Lander away. They ultimately separate him from the man, push him against a wall by the elevators, and place handcuffs on him. You do not have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens, Mr. Lander says repeatedly, according to the video. I'm not obstructing. I'm standing right here in the hallway. I asked to see the judicial warrant. Agents do not need judicial warrants to make arrests in immigration courts because they are public spaces, according to immigration lawyers. Oh, Bob.
Joe, it's I have so many, many issues here. It seems like there is an accepted policy of targeting leaders, political leaders, by ICE. I mean, I've said for actually many years on the show that I felt that ICE had become a feral organization, and this continues to prove my point. They right now, though, are unfettered. I'm also really, really disturbed with the fact that the position that we're putting people in who are trying to work through the legal system in order to potentially achieve legal migrant status here, legal status, that even going through the process jeopardizes them. So I mean, we're creating these double and triple jeopardies. And something that Teresa and I were talking about before the show that really bothers me is these masked, non-uniformed officers engaging in arrests. How do we even know that these are law enforcement officers? And I worry because people who I talk to who are generally very supportive of law enforcement at all levels look at these tactics and say, you know, it creates doubt in my mind about who truly is an officer of the law versus who isn't. You know, Joe, what's the difference right now between a gang of thugs and ICE? I can't tell you because I can't. You know, the only thing you can say is, you know, they're not showing identification. They're not going through the process. And you know, I think at the local level, the idea of being arrested, you have to identify yourself. You know, you've got to be able to show a badge number. There is due process, and I think the idea of a political leader who is asking, I think, for a very reasonable question, and is then assaulted by those ICE officials. You know, I would argue that there should be charges of assault made against those individuals. I also will note, Joe, that this is a disturbing feature in my mind of the gross decision out of the Supreme Court about presidential immunity, and extending this idea of presidential immunity into the executive branch, which is giving sense to the most base instincts of these folks that they can do anything the hell they want to do because Trump is going to bail them out. And he did. I mean, this is what happens with January 6th, and folks look at it and say, we can do whatever we want if we keep him happy because he's going to pardon us no matter what we do.
You know, if for any readers that have not read It Can't Happen Here, I read it last year, and there is there's a part in that book where the Congress is arrested and taken into protective custody because it's for their own protection. And you read that and it's like, well, that's not going to happen. And yet we're seeing the handcuffing, the arresting, and the charging of elected officials who simply disagree in a vocal way, in a very in-your-face way, but disagree with the administration's policies. And, you know, some years ago, when Trump, I think it was in his first term, when he announced that he was going to hire 50,000, I think was the number, new people in Homeland Security, the first thing that went through my head was, what what is going to be the type of person who is going to apply for that job, given the rhetoric of a president who is basically saying, I'm going to do mass deportations. We are seeing who they are now. You look at the people who are doing this in the videos. These are not old officers. These are young people who have just been hired probably in the last few years, who are loaded for bear and are ready to do exactly what we're witnessing in front of us. And thugs, gangs, is what we're seeing. And every one of these arrests, we're not seeing, we may not be seeing a mass arrest of Congress yet. We are seeing the steady normalization of this behavior.
Yes.
Who wants our final 90 seconds?
I would just say that I think that this is the kind of situation that we see step by step by step spinning out of control. It's not just that book, but we can go back to Europe, 1990s, saw it with my own eyes in the Balkans. Bob's point about, you know, who is really carrying the guns? Who's behind those masks? This mixing of Proud Boys, people let out from J6 crimes, and federal agents, and who knows who they really are? We've seen it with our own eyes. We've seen where it goes, and it doesn't go anyplace good.
I think we have to remember there is common agreement that yes, you arrest and detain illegal immigrants who are committing violent crimes. But they are going so far beyond that. And cheers to Governor Hochul for calling that out, and for the other Governor Pritzker and others, that people are trying to do this lawfully. They have cut funding that allows people a lawful pathway. And look at the budgets, what they're proposing, $46.5 billion for barriers, $45 billion for private detention centers. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they're cutting $32 billion out of the HUD budget. So no rental assistance, you know, a whole series of housing programs being cut. They are proposing to spend $45 billion for private detention centers. This is a real problem, folks, and we have to focus on it.
Very meaningful and in-depth conversation this morning. I thank all of you for participating and for being so thoughtful and respectful. I greatly appreciate it. And a great honor to be with you all. Jim Ketterer, Jay Jochnowitz, Bob Griffin, and what's your name? Teresa. I love you all. What's your name? Teresa Bourgeois, thank you so much for being with us. Yeah, the God only knows, that's right. Thank you all. We'll be right back after this.